of me. Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
It belongs to me. Get off my world. It's fair.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. If you don't, you're gonna get it.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. Or I'm gonna bury you.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World live at Convergence. We're three guys and the occasional guests who love the classic Doctor Who series and occasionally feign a tolerance of the new series too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. Our special guests today are local actor, local actor and geek girl extraordinaire, Ariel Leaf.
Yay.
And this guy, LA-based geek comedian, Joseph Scrimshaw.
Yay.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to kick off the podcast with round one, something we like to call temporal grace. Sometimes we get a little about Doctor Who, so we like to start the podcast.
We
by...
make cat noises.
Yeah.
When we're
yeah.
Yeah,
it sounded like a cat version of the opening theme of Doctor Who is going to start.
That didn't go as I expected. We get a little bitchy about Doctor Who sometimes.
That's right.
So that's why we like to start things off with something that makes us happy about the universe of Doctor Who. And why don't we have our guests start? Ariel?
I will start, although mine might be a little bit of both. I have to say that the thing that I'm very happy about is that Jenna Coleman is no longer on the new Doctor Who. Mm. I knew that was going to come, but I find her just truly a boring companion. I can't even hate her. She's just dull. I just found myself sleeping through a number of her episodes, so I'm really excited to see this new companion and see how the two of them play together.
Joseph?
Cool. Do you want something I sincerely like, or do you want me to backhandedly attack Jenna Coleman?
I think we have that covered.
Okay. This is kind of like a nice bookend, because I was rewatching an episode that we're going to talk about a little bit later, Hartnell Era, and I was reminded how much I like Ian Chesterton, sort of the original proto-companion, and I was reminded how much I like him because he is generally kind of calm and nice, but then just gets crap done. And I thought, man, I would really like someone in my life like Ian Chesterton, where he's like, you know, hey, I can figure out the, you know, taxes on this check, you know, when I was like, I can figure out how much you should tip at this restaurant, or if you need me to punch someone, I could do that too. I'm kind of down for whatever.
The 12th Doctor could use someone like that.
He really could.
What, you have to tip? What?
Kelvin?
I think for me, I was very entertained by David Tennant reading mean Scottish anti-Trump tweets on the Samantha Bee show. No one can cuss like a Scotsman.
And was that canonical to Doctor Who?
It involves a Doctor Who actor.
Mm-hmm. No, Big Finish will have a box set out by the end of
yeah. It's just David Tennant reading mean tweets.
Joshua?
Well, speaking of Big Finish, my happy thing is I recently listened to the 10th Doctor box set from Big Finish, David Tennant returning to the role for a series of three audio adventures. And anyone who knows me knows that David Tennant and the 10th Doctor, I should say the 10th Doctor, because I actually think David Tennant's a fine actor, but the 10th Doctor was not my favorite Doctor. I spent most of those years griping to the point that people wanted to punch me. However, I really enjoyed these audios a lot, and I realized that the new series has been on so long, I have nostalgic feelings about disliking the 10th Doctor. I was like, oh, there's another little quirk I hate. Oh, I can't wait to listen to the next one. Oh,
I miss 2000 and hate.
Well, for my temporal grace, I'm not even going to talk about Doctor Who. I've just been having like a really chill convention, and it's been fun for me. What I've been enjoying this weekend, and I've been coming to this since the first year. Oh my God. But things just seem very much more diverse now than they used to. Also lots more accommodation to non-standard gender identifying people and stuff. All this pronoun business is, I think it's really cool. So this is kind of part of the fandom that I've existed in for a long time and seeing it kind of grow and expand. Doctor Who's a part of that, of course, but this is what's been on my mind this weekend.
Awesome.
Okay, and now it's time for round two, what we call Special Topics Dalek. And in this round, we ask one of our guests to bring us a Doctor Who-related discussion topic that therefore becomes discussed. And let's start with Ariel. Do you have something?
Yes, yeah. I was actually inspired because I bought the box set of Wonder Woman out of nostalgia because I used to love Wonder Woman as a kid. And when I watched it, it was completely ruined for me watching Linda Carter attempt to run in these heeled boots. She lost all her power for me. It just looked really awkward and clunky. And so I was inspired to go back and look through Doctor Who to look for the least practical shoes, outfit, and hair of any companion.
Did you come to any conclusions?
I did. Well, the shoes were a tie. The shoes were a tie between Martha has this pair of black boots with this thin little heel that's about this tall. And I just, in some crucial moment, that's just going to snap and she's going to bail. But Romana, too, also continues to wear this pair of ridiculous red heels. Ridiculous red heels. And so all of them, I just expect them to get caught in a sewer grate at some point, and they really should just, you know, face plant, and that should be the end of them. When it came to clothing, you know, that also, there were a few ties in there. There were a couple skirts that I thought, can you really move in that very well? But I went with Jamie's kilt in the end, particularly if he's not wearing underwear underneath. That could be really problematic. I just read a book that was released where they were on an ice planet. It. And Jamie is like skiing in his kilt. And I just thought that could end up really unfortunate at some point.
Oh my Gideon.
And then least practical hair was a easy win for me with Mel.
Not only
could someone grab her by it, but how many times would she be blinded as that frizzy redness just passed in front of her face?
Giant 80s mall hair. I've never understood it. Well, the first person that comes to my mind is Tegan, because she's always wearing that stewardess outfit. And, like, what can you do in a stewardess outfit except stewardess, you know?
She changed eventually.
She eventually changed into one of, you know, John Nathan Turner's odd ideas of what women were wearing at the time.
I like that skirt, though, the pencil leather skirt.
Oh, yeah,
sure. The 80s Nagel-looking.
Oh, yeah, house. Sure,
she's
but...
always ready to
I don't know if you can
video.
Run away from a Dalek in that very well.
Yeah, I suppose I'd have to say that they really should have given Susan more ankle support in whatever she was wearing, because she's always falling down and twisting things.
Yeah, Susan was definitely my answer, because that goes beyond shoe wear. That's something that she herself is doing wrong in walking. She's not good at walking.
I realize that I've never looked at a female companion from the ankles down. I cannot conjure up any footwear of any companion.
Susan's footwear, I think, is pretty reasonable. I think she's got like little flats. You know, it should be good for running. So I don't know what her problem is.
She's got bad ankles.
Yeah, it's a bad regeneration for ankles.
They don't teach walking on Gallifrey.
That would be the worst thing that happened to Doctor. He regenerates and has incredibly weak ankles. Instead of run, he'd be shouting, "Carry me."
If you're talking about practicality, though, I always think of all the rings that Jo Grant wears.
Mm.
And she's supposed to be like a master lock picker, too. And you see her like going through a ring of keys or something, and there's just all this stuff on her hand. She looks like Liberace trying to pick a lock. It's just...
How about fashion? Is there any particular fashion disasters? Anything after about 1980?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Mel's outfit in the Happiness... No, was it the...
Is
not
it
that,
the blue and white?
Not the Happiness Patrol.
Paradise Towers.
Blue with white polka dots top and, like, white with blue polka dots bottom.
And I think each of her lapels was one or the other. It was very blinding.
Yeah, it was like really terrible motion capture outfit before that was a thing.
I do like the idea of seeing the classic Monster Vision and then just seeing a horrible outfit from the 80s. And just, nope.
What about Leela? Because if, I mean, her outfit is practical for fighting. Fighting and exotic dancing.
She gets range of motion, but she also has a lot of exposed flesh.
Yeah, there might not be mosquitoes or things to worry about on the jungle planet that she's from.
I think it's a point of pride of like, I don't need armor. I'll kill you. You'll never touch me. I'll kill you. I don't need any protection.
When I heard this question, I almost thought it's much easier to just decide who has the most practical outfit, because there would be so few of those. And I think there's got to be someone like Ace.
Yeah, her backpack. Yeah.
Just functional.
Oh, functional. She can move. She can run. She can blow crap up. What else do you need?
Everything you need.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts, Ariel?
Oh, no, I just enjoyed this mightily. I realized it was incredibly hard to actually find photographs of the companions from the ankle down. Not too hard to find a lot of photos of them from the waist up, but I actually had to go through and watch a lot of episodes, so that was sort of the most fun thing about it for me. It was, you know, fast-forwarding through episodes, looking for shoes.
A whole new way to watch Doctor
Excellent. And now we're going to move on to round three, the Death Zone. In this round, we scoop up two Doctor Who stories and plunk them into the Death Zone to see which one wins. Today, we'll be pitting First Doctor's story, Edge of Destruction, versus the 10th Doctor's story, Midnight. Would you care to give us a little setup?
Yeah, so Edge of Destruction was the third Doctor Who story ever. It's a bottle episode starring Ian Barbara Susan and the Doctor, and it takes place entirely in the TARDIS interior, and we see a lot more of the TARDIS than we had up to that point. And spooky things go wrong. Midnight is a Russell T. Davies episode from Tennant's fourth season, because Donna is the companion.
Although it's a companion light episode. Yes.
Right. And they're stuck in a car.
Or
bus. Tour bus. Tour bus. And spooky things go wrong. So this is the Death Zone. So we're going to argue the merits and demerits of each of these stories. And one of them is going to come out on top. And the other one will flush down a memory hole. I don't know. Do something with it.
Is that a Doctor Who term that I've forgotten? Is that
the memory hole?
Is there a memory hole?
Sorry.
In the TARDIS?
Getting a little Orwellian.
Time Lords stare into the memory hole as children. And
that's what happened
insane.
To the Master.
So let's start with the Edge of Destruction.
Yeah, I just rewatched that. And I had very, very fond memories of it from, I probably hadn't seen it in like 15 years. I had very fond memories because I always liked the soap opera elements of the classic series where you got to see the characters just kind of alone and interacting. And I remember thinking that it was super cool to just see so much of the TARDIS. And then when I rewatched it, I was mostly shocked and just wanted to hang out with Ian Chesterton. So just the fact that for the first episode of the two-part, it's inscrutable what's going on. It's just like everybody is just behaving oddly for a half hour. It feels like...
It's like
some
a Beckett
sort of,
play, that first episode.
Yeah, it is like a poorly
without any
Beckett
subtext,
play.
Yeah, or yeah. thematic significance. But.
Yeah, and I had forgot that, of course, the serials... I remembered that the serials at the time all had their own name, and then we've only later condensed them to the one specific name. And I was really entertained that Edge of Destruction second episode was something like Brink of Disaster.
Yeah.
And it was just sounding like it was being named by the most paranoid, over-the-top person. And I wished it was like eight episodes long, so each one could have been like, Precipice of Failure.
Lip of Doom.
Lip of Doom. Everything's going wrong soon now.
Yeah, I found myself, I understood that there some of the basic things that were happening as I was watching it. Okay, clearly people are getting possessed or something at some point, but I had trouble following who is being affected when. Suddenly everybody would stop and stare at something and clutch their heads, and I couldn't always follow their eyes to see what it was that was triggering them. Like at one point there was, I guess, a melted watch that was supposed to be having an effect, but I couldn't really follow that that's what was happening.
It's hard because there's so many drop lines from that era, because sometimes when someone stops and grabs their head, I just think they're trying to come up with the next line.
Yeah, I think sometimes they're just like glaring at the director. Like, come on, give us something to work with.
Yeah, and the melted clock isn't very legible with the black and white cinematography. It goes by very quickly. What is that? I don't even know what Barbara's yelling at.
And this is early enough in the show that it still wasn't entirely established whether the Doctor was like a hero or an anti-hero.
No, he's going to throw people out of the TARDIS.
Yeah,
Then he roofies everybody.
He's really... His persona as a hero hadn't really crystallized yet, so that must have been very strange.
Yeah, it's kind of neat that it occurs so early in the series, because it's just a difference in degree to how they've been interacting with one another up to this point. Because, as you say, we don't really know who the character of the Doctor is yet. And Hartnell is very
good at it. Well, their intense distrust of each other made me wonder how they could ever stand traveling together at all. I mean, it's just nothing but pointing fingers and kind of loathing each other.
Once again, it's always Barbara that talks people down. She's so good at this. She really lays into Hartnell about...
You stupid old man.
Ian saved your life in the Cave of Skulls. And what about the Daleks? Blah, blah, blah. It's continuity heavy right from the beginning there. These last two things.
But you can see that this is where Russell Davies pulled this sort of relational view of Doctor Who from these early episodes, because it is so much about their personal interaction and these sort of cathartic emotional moments between them. It reminded me of Clara yelling at the 12th Doctor.
Yeah, absolutely, because it was, I had forgotten that the Doctor does kind of have that moment of appreciating Barbara, and instead of just kind of grumpily going along with something, that he like actually really listens and understands that she was right.
Yeah, it's a sweet moment at the end. I think that makes the whole episode worth it, especially because the Doctor compliments her pants. And I don't know why that's so funny to me. They're very, very charming
pants.
They're
so practical.
And I just want to say that I really love that the whole problem from the whole thing is a stuck spring.
Yeah.
In a switch.
That is the biggest contrast to modern Doctor Who. If we open this up, you can pull in the whole essence of the time vortex. But also, there's a spring. And if the spring pops,
And the switch is labeled with felt tip pen.
Yeah, it just made me imagine that if like that spring, that one spring was so vital and it could send the TARDIS back to the beginning of time, which is basically like the problem, right?
Yeah.
Of the episode to the edge of destruction, then I was imagining like when Rose sucked in all the power that she also got that spring. The spring was inside her.
Just joking.
So did I miss it, or is there no in-story explanation for why they're acting so weird?
It's the TARDIS trying to tell them something is wrong, but it doesn't have like the right kind of communication interface to do that.
You know, it's somehow
it's like, I don't have fingers, someone needs to get to the spring, so I guess I'll just take turns possessing you and having you attack each other until you figure this out.
Yeah, just like triggering some kind of instinctual sense of danger, but you know, you can't, not being able to communicate anything more than that.
It still seems like there could have been a little more specificity. I think like the TARDIS would be the worst charades partner.
As a confirmed fan of stock footage of this era, I was happy to see that picture of trees in a field on the scanner that they use like every third episode.
Do you cheer when they come up?
I do.
When you sit in,
I like, trees in a field. Yeah, trees in a field, volcanoes.
Fast moving clouds. Yes.
I also want to mention that Barbara suggests that another intelligence might have gotten into the ship. And I'm wondering where she got that idea from. They've only been to the cavemen and the Daleks.
Right.
So it's like, is there some missing adventure where they encounter disembodied intelligences? Or why would she go there in her head?
Yeah, I mean, maybe she read a lot of science fiction before she left.
I wonder if because when, I can't remember who gets sort of possessed first, is it Susan? She doesn't seem to recognize the other people at first. And that might be where Barbara gets that idea. Like, if you don't know who we are, then who are you?
Yeah, and Ian goes all amnesiac, too. Yeah, William Russell decides to just act like a pod person. What? Robotic.
I have to admit, I was legitimately scared to see Susan, like, pull the scissors in that one scene. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of startled by that. Like, that early in the show, they did something that dark. Where, like, Susan is totally willing to stab someone.
Yeah, I believe that. I don't know if that was the actor's stress or if it was good acting, but I really believe that.
I want out of my contract now!
I want even more practical shoes.
Wrong sleep number. Really angry.
Yeah, she really messed up that ergonomically questionable bed.
So we have decided they never explained, and I don't know if it's intentional or not, the ambiguity of whether they turned on each other so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because they hate each other,
or
there was actual mind powers. I think as a modern viewer, you can sort of retroactively go back and say it was, the TARDIS's, you know, telepathic circuits making him behave that way. But there's no in-story explanation. I did read somewhere on the internet, so it has to be true, of course, that there was maybe some more explaining lines that William Hartnell just totally skipped over.
Yeah, it makes
sense. Does that seem true?
Well, probably.
It seems.
I'm going
to
assume.
Sure or not,
it
seems like a great story. It doesn't have to be true.
So he was supposed to explain something everything. Important to the plot, and instead he said,
instead he just said, "Don't underestimate my powers." It's always terrible when he flubs the tough guy lines.
You know, he also explicitly says, "My machine can't think." So at this point in the series, it's a machine, it's a ship.
It's not she.
It's
yet.
Not she.
I like interpreting it that the Doctor is just being a jerk to the TARDIS, too. That, like, he has some inkling that it has sentience, and he's just being a jerk.
Yeah.
Because that's his character. That's my headcanon for this episode.
I will say it is kind of nice from the third episode of this series that they established the TARDIS as a dangerous place, because I think most TV series would say, oh, this is home base. This is a safe place to go. When we get to the TARDIS at the end of an adventure, we're safe. But this sort of makes you question that, like just a handful of stories in.
Yeah.
There's no safe place for these poor SOBs.
Well, let's talk about Midnight for a little bit. This is a pretty well-regarded story by Russell T. Davies standards. Is it...
Backhand!
Is that something that we agree with?
No, I would say it's my favorite Russell T. Davies story.
Oh.
I was really affected by it. I found it incredibly heartbreaking, actually.
It's like one of the very rare stories in any period of Doctor Who where, like, oh my God, the Doctor could die here. Like I was legitimately scared for the Doctor in this episode.
Yeah, the last time I rewatched it, I watched the whole episode, enjoyed it very much. I was like, that's not by Russell T. Davies. Rewound, like, it's just, I think Russell T. Davies does some great stuff, but a lot of the tropes that he was doing in that period, heavy-handedly, he wasn't doing in this episode.
Right,
so it's
yeah.
very, very weird, and I would like to know more about the backstory of why he wrote, I mean, I understand the whole Companion Light, the budget of that, but it's just interesting to me that he threw out so many of the ideas that he was obsessed with in all his other episodes.
And in many ways, it's a very typical Russell setup, because it's a bunch of random middle-class people tossed together in an environment and forced to, you know, explain their lives to one another.
Yeah.
But it's done in a... Well, better.
Yeah. I don't think it was meant in a meta way, but I enjoy it in a meta way because it feels a little bit almost like commentary on people's different strong opinions about the 10th Doctor. Because it's got him being cheeky and, oh gosh, I love humanity, and really connecting with people as a person. And then everybody's kind of like, yeah, but eventually, and we're in love with you for a while, the people on the space bus. And they're like,
eventually.
Maybe we should just throw you out of this space bus. Maybe we've had enough of cheeky, cheeky, happy guy who's suddenly like, but no, I'm also in command and a god. You're like, wait a minute. You don't get to be both, guy.
It's just kind of fascinating because just by random weird coincidence, Cinema Rex here at Convergence, one of the movies they showed was Lifeboat.
Oh.
Hitchcock's Lifeboat. And this is Doctor Who's Lifeboat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same kind of a thing.
And I think it was also cool commentary when we have a Doctor Who knows everything. Like, the 10th Doctor just seems to have more in his data banks than even other doctors. Like, I don't think other doctors know the lyrics to Ghostbusters, but for some reason, the 10th Doctor does. So the fact that that doctor in particular is faced with something that he doesn't know what it is, I think, one of the things that makes it really, really powerful.
And I like his wonderfully progressive response to it, too. If you need form or consciousness or voice, you don't need to hurt anyone. I'll help you. He doesn't even know what it is. It might not even be a real intelligence at all, but it's like, oh, my first response is, I will help you.
Yeah.
So.
But he also, it's interesting because he proved to be really wrong.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it is interesting because it subverts a lot of new series idealized humanity tropes.
Yeah.
Like when he makes that speech to them, you know, if you throw this woman out, that's murder. Are you ready to murder people?
And this, and you expect them to sort of all come to
you. And they're like, yes, starting with you, you know. It's you totally don't see that coming.
So you guys know that I like to get really pretentious on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And pompous.
Yeah. A bit.
So we're all clear on that.
Yes, let's do it.
I do want to point out that they quote Christina Rossetti's great poem, Goblin Market, in this episode, which makes it worth the price of admission by itself. If you don't know that poem, that's amazing. But then also, I've been reading Henry James. This is true. And at one point, he talks about the history of travel, and he kind of breaks it down into first explorers, then travelers, then tourists. And that's kind of the history of global travel. And that, I think that kind of works as a metaphor for where Doctor Who has gone from, too. First, you explore places, like back in the old classic series, and then you sort of travel to see the cultural sites of places, and then eventually you're on a space bus talking about Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it is kind of, this is the Doctor just straight up being a tourist. Yep. He's not drawn to Midnight because of, I detected some force here or something.
No, he just thinks It would be cool to see a crystal waterfall.
Yeah. Which would be cool.
I think one of the things that I saw a lot throughout Tennant's time was this want to bring a child back. This sort of, he has the same childlike wonder that normally the companions are more likely to have. And instead of being this expert, he's sort of thrown into that same kind of, let's go here because it would be fun, not because something important needs to happen or he needs to fix something.
And Donda's like, nope, I'm staying here and getting a pedicure.
Yeah.
Also, in that montage where time is passing in the shuttle and he's talking to the various passengers, often in the new series, and one of the things that irked me about it, everyone always falls instantly in love with the Doctor. He never annoys anybody. But in those vignettes, he's not the center of attention. He's, leaning over a seat listening to, Space Dad tell some bad joke, and he's laughing with everybody else. He's on the outside, and he feels more like a kind of classic.
Yeah, well, he's totally validating what he says a lot in the new series of, like, everybody matters. You just, two people getting married on a Sunday, that's the most important. Like, he says so many times, like, the little moments matter. So it's cool for him for once to actually sit there and listen to people's stories.
Yeah.
Because for the most part, he says, every little life matters. Bye.
This is boring.
I just don't want to be around them.
Yeah.
They matter.
I do like that he sabotages the in-flight entertainment system with a sonic screwdriver, so they're forced to talk to each other.
That is one Russell T. Davies trope that definitely does get used in this story rather prominently. It's like, the future is exactly like the modern day. the exact same annoyances that we deal with, like, force-fed pop culture entertainment on flights or whatever. Like,
yeah, and I always like that when I am in the middle of binge-watching a show. I was rewatching the new series, binge-watching it, and then when the show presents the moral of, like, turn off the television and talk to other people. Are you talking to me?
Well, you guys, this is the Death Zone.
So what are you talking about?
So one of these episodes has to die?
Yeah. We have to decide as a panel which one of these is the superior story. Does anyone have any thoughts?
I have to go with Midnight being the most superior story. I think particularly because you're left without answers at the end, and I always like being left to imagine more. What was this creature? What will it do next?
And you're suggesting that the lack of answers in Midnight is intentional as opposed to the lack of answers in Edge of Destruction.
Yeah.
Because they both have a lack of answer at the end.
It's a good example of ambiguity being done well.
Yeah, right. I think Midnight is well-constructed, fascinating ambiguity, and Edge of Destruction has some wonderful moments, but most of its ambiguity comes from William Hartnell forgetting things.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated by Edge of Destruction because it is literally a two-part filler episode that they had to throw together on the fly because they just wound up realizing they were two episodes short of what they were contracted to do. And in a weird way, it wound up contributing to a lot to Doctor Who mythos of just, like the TARDIS being this sort of semi-unknowable entity and things like that.
Yeah, this is a tough choice for me because I legit like both of these stories. But ultimately, I'm going to be kind of contrary and go with Edge of Destruction as the superior one for a lot of those reasons that you just mentioned, Colin, because this is the show creating itself in very early days. It's making stuff up as it goes along, and it's just sort of fascinating to watch all of that. Midnight, as much as I like it, still had RTD stuff that kind of bugged me at the end, like the random stewardess who saves the day by sacrificing her lives, which is what I used to do as a Call of Cthulhu GM when I didn't want to kill all my players. NPC, like, throw the dynamite in the thing's mouth.
If I made a special edition of Midnight where we included a picture of trees in a field, could I get you to vote for Midnight?
Yes.
Okay. Do you guys vote? Do you declare an absolute winner here?
Yeah, will we vote? Yeah.
We've already lost, Pat. I will say I think Midnight is a great piece of television. I guess we are all looking at this through different lenses, too.
Yeah.
I think Edge of Destruction is maybe a braver, more experimental piece of television, looking at it in his historical context. And the Doctor compliments someone's pants, which I just can't get
well,
away
I do
from.
Think coming this early, putting rift between the companions and the companions and the Doctor is very risky, because inherently you'd think you'd want to draw your audience in by really coming to trust all of these people before you take that kind of leap. So I do think it is a brave episode.
Yeah, I think the central question of both episodes is the Doctor a dick? When it comes right down to it, because the edge of destruction, the companions are getting to know him and their relationships and questioning the safety of being with him. And then I think in Midnight, it kind of had the same thing happens with the tour bus. We see this flashy, lovable guy who's going to bring us all together, and they absolutely turn on him. And I think it makes us question Tennant more.
Mm-hmm. And I think they both have failures at the end, and that Edge of Destruction is a failure of exposition, you know?
That was the fourth episode. That was the title of the fourth episode.
Failures of exposition.
Failure
of exposition.
The Ledge of Exposition. We're almost there. And then I have to echo, because we didn't really talk about it much, Pat's comments about the hostess at the end. It was a really unearned conclusion, which I think undermined that great idea of the Doctor losing and being utterly gone.
I liked it, because I think it contributed to Tenth Doctor's feeling of, I really don't know what happened, and I'm in fact not going to look into it.
All right, so, well, I think we're outvoted. I think Midnight is going to take it.
And take that, treason afield.
But now for round four, we have another special topics Dalek.
An STD, if you will.
Oh,
give us all an STD.
Joe.
Thank you for asking me to bring the second STD. She'll hopefully compliment the first one. So my special topics Dalek question was, if you guys had the ability to regenerate like the Doctor, what foolish or dangerous thing would you do? Because you know I can just regenerate. Calvin?
Oh, great. I'm the first one.
I can come back to you if you want.
Yeah, you got to get Calvin thinking now so we can get back.
Yeah, yeah.
Calvin, start thinking about what dangerous thing you'd like to do with your body.
I am someone who has to process things for, you know, weeks and years before I come up to a conclusion about anything.
Well, I'll come back to you at next year's Convergence.
Yes.
To be continued.
Joshua?
Wow. I mean, if I had to think about it, I guess I do. It's a podcast. I would say that I would go back to school. That's the most dangerous, irresponsible thing I can think of. Because think about it. If you're talking about time, right? Because that's my enemy as a 24-year-old man. Mm-hmm. You could go back and keep getting more and more useless degrees. Then afterwards, you work for a nonprofit for 10 years. I mean, work in air quotes because it's a nonprofit. Right. And then you get your loan forgiven, and you regenerate and go back to school. You can get all sorts of useless liberal arts degree.
So you would do something emotionally dangerous with your time.
Totally irresponsible.
Not physically dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, I guess tattoos. Dumb tattoos would be great because you don't have to worry about them.
Well, right? I mean, that it would certainly...
If you didn't like it, if you got a little older and went, that's kind of stupid, why'd I get that mom tattoo?
Yeah, that
by mom
really
tattoo,
mean.
I mean like my entire mom's body tattoo. I mean something really weird.
Oh, yeah.
Stop imagining it, Joe.
No, I can't. I can't. I want you to be able to zip yourself in and out of it like the Celine. Okay. How about you, Pat?
Well, my instinct is to go really dark with this.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I'd be tempted. I don't know if I could bring myself to do it, but I'd be tempted to assassinate, like, evil billionaires and bad politicians, otherwise untouchable by normal means.
What? Right. So you would force the revolution through violence.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I would.
So Pat would become the Doctor.
Yeah. I might get away with it because they'd be like, who's that guy?
Yeah.
So
far you guys are both saying you would become enemies of the Doctor. Because Pat, you would become a murderer that the Doctor probably wouldn't accept. And Joshua, I think you would anger the Doctor because you would be accumulating all this knowledge and doing nothing with it.
Yes.
Not making the world a better place in any way.
Nope, not leaving that ivory tower.
Okay, so so far, continuing education and murder have been taken, Ariel. What physically or emotionally dangerous thing would you do with yourself if you could regenerate?
Well, I think now that I'm a new parent, I am less likely to put myself physically at risk because I need to be there for this tiny person. And one of the things I always planned to do that I didn't get to before my daughter was born was to try skydiving. And when I think of other, you know, big physical risks like that, if your chute doesn't open, suddenly your child doesn't have a parent anymore. But if I could regenerate, I think I would get on a plane tomorrow and jump out of it.
Yeah, Tom Baker fell, and he regenerated, and he was just fine.
He turned into Peter Davison, and everything was great.
Oh, boy.
How about you, Calvin?
We gave you a lot of time there.
We did, yeah. I was kind of thinking something along the lines of what Pat said, but maybe not, you know, outright murder.
You would just scold people and regenerate,
just scold
right?
People, yeah.
So you would try to get close to people that you disagree with politically and take
like
the risk of being shot or whatever?
Wrong. Damn it.
You know, when you can regenerate, a life sentence in jail is actually pretty bad.
It would be. I shudder to think of what, like, Shada would actually be like. You're like, oh, this Time Lord needs to be imprisoned.
Yeah. Is there anything physical, like Ariel, that you stop yourself and say, like, that's a little too risky, I don't want to do that. Like, do you ever just want to run with scissors?
You could become a professional cheese taster. Apparently, that's the most dangerous job in the world.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well,
the cholesterol, apparently.
Oh, I assumed it was just bizarre cheese toxins.
I really like
that's my new
those.
Order cover band.
Bizarre cheese.
Bring it, Listeria. I can regenerate.
But
I want you to do both. I want you to be eating bags of mysterious cheese as you run up like a crazy man to politicians. You don't like. I want some words with you, Sarah Palin.
Try some raw milk cheese.
Or maybe just like taking certain kinds of relationship risks or something, like going up to people and making overtures and then like, oh hey, I didn't die. Or wait, I did die, but it's okay. I could try that again some other time or something.
All right, I think that's a good answer. My answer is pretty much, I think I would be tempted to just use it as a party trick. Something's just really boring, you know, when you throw a really bad party. And you're just like, hey,
watch
this. Come into the bathroom with this toaster. Yeah. Check this out. Look what I can do.
Let's regenerate the party.
Exactly.
Can you regenerate from alcohol poisoning? That would be one question I would answer.
Oh, yeah, I think. Yeah, that sadly, that is probably just the really honest version.
Yeah, when your liver's failing, do you just...
Yeah.
Change and not a moment too soon.
Yes, I would pick like the right bar, the right party, and just it's hard to get alcohol poisoning in like a big spectacular way.
No, right?
there's like a
Russell T. Davies regeneration.
There's like a random wino sleeping on a park bench under a pile of newspapers, and then suddenly they glow.
Yeah, I really like that. That guy exploded in a park. Yeah. What?
What's going on in that soup kitchen?
Well, thank you for answering my special topic style question with a lot of emotional horror.
It really was. We need help. Okay, and now, guys, round 5, the deadly assassin. And a lot of people in the audience here already helped us get some suggestions for this round. In this round, we take a Doctor Who story, novel, audio, character, logo, abstract, concept, whatever, and one of us will viciously attack it, attempt to assassinate it, regardless of its merits or lack thereof. Meanwhile, someone else must thwart the assassination attempt with all their might, again, regardless of the merits or lack thereof. And today we are going to do a special lightning round version of this based on your topics. Pat?
A lot of interesting stuff here. Fewer episodes than I expected, but lots of things or concepts. So what are the pros and cons of a ginger doctor? I assume that means a redheaded doctor and not ginger from Gilligan's Island as the doctor.
I would watch Ginger from Gilligan's Island doctor myself.
I'm still processing that. Wow.
Yeah.
Kelvin, defend.
Stuck on that island.
Ariel, attack.
Why not? Why not have a red-haired doctor? There's no particular reason why there hasn't been a red-haired doctor. Would they do something really stupid like give him an Irish accent for no reason? I don't think so.
Well, I think the biggest problem is that he'd be incredibly temperamental, and we need our doctor to be really stable. So I think I think we're risking too much with throwing the Irish temperament in there.
Okay.
You're not supposed to agree, Calvin. He just rolled over.
You're right. I'm sorry.
Victory is mine.
I'm gonna eat some cheese. Well, now. You know,
I mean, we could have a doctor who looks like, say, Jimmy Olsen.
Superman's pal?
Yeah, that'd be adorable. Like, just...
again, it's the companion's job to be adorable.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm gonna Calvin give... Halley is the agreeable assassin.
I'm gonna give the victory to Ariel on this one.
Yeah.
Calvin gave it to her. Why not?
The story Nightmare in Silver. Joshua, defend it.
Oh.
Joseph, attack it.
Okay. Here is the problem with Nightmare in Silver. Every time that you get a new announcement of some Cybermen appearing, you expect it to be exciting, and then the Cybermen never really manage to be as cool as they look. That's their horrible problem that is only accentuated in Nightmare in Silver.
Neil Gaiman wrote it. There's a little person in it.
Neil Gaiman wrote it, and it is, Neil, you know what? It is the Doctor Who equivalent of the Matrix sequels, right? Because the Doctor's wife, Neil Gaiman wrote, everybody loved it, mm-hmm. celebrated it like the mm-hmm. original Matrix. Then there was a follow-up, and instead of hating it, nobody ever speaks of it.
Well, I think it's very clever of Neil Gaiman, who has a lot of other books and TV projects to work on, so he very intentionally lowered the bar so that he could just sort of back away from Doctor Who and get to all the other things he has to do. No one's clamoring, please, Neil, write us another episode like Nightmare in Silver. I think it's very clever.
Right. If your argument is that he purposely tanked it to get out of working on stupid old Doctor Who, then I think the episode is indeed a success.
Yeah. Thank you for agreeing with me.
I agreed in that sort of Kelvin Jenna Coleman way that yes. Ariel introduced us to in the beginning. I think it is a great, great failure.
Advantage Joseph.
Yeah.
I don't agree with anything I said either. I really like the episode.
Yeah,
I really do. I think people are unduly harsh on it, and I think it's got a wonderful classic series feel in parts of it.
You're defending it now.
Yeah,
I know, but
okay.
I'm done.
Shut up.
I already won. I won, and then I wanted to put some positivity in the world, like the Doctor would do.
Perry's fate in Trial of a Time Lord.
Some of the problems I have with a lot of episodes that I have in this one is that it lets things off the hook. Like, I think that we should have had to go through the emotional loss of Perry. I think that that was important. And instead, right at the end, they said, oh, wait. Let's all feel really good. Instead, she can go off and marry the hunky
Brian Blessed. I think that if the show was a different show at the time, we could have gone through that emotional loss of Perry. But the end of Mind Warp is so bizarre, and you don't even really know what's real and what's in... it faked by the Gallifreyan Matrix, that I think to have Perry actually dead would have been an infuriating cheat. So if we can't get her, she can marry Brian Blessed, and there will never be a dull moment in her life, and we can feel good for her.
I guess, but also as someone who absolutely couldn't stand Perry, I would really like her to have died. So
I can't follow you there, because I love Perry. All the wrong reasons.
That's another argument we should have at some point.
Well, I can't judge this one, so did either...
I think Ariel's hate came across more clearly.
Than your love of Perry's.
Of Perry.
It's a private love.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just mad that we didn't get to see the romance. I think that would have been...
Oh, yeah. That
I can't even begin to picture that romance.
Well, today we would get webisodes of that. It would be Perry and King Yorkanas at home.
Yeah. I have slain for you this animal. I got a frozen pizza! There's an ood on the loo. Kill it!
Oh, yeah.
He would just yell, I want to marry you so loud that she would marry him just to get him to shut up.
The KLF's Doctor in the TARDIS.
I would defend it.
I would defend it, too.
We can defend it together. We're brothers.
Yeah.
Yay!
Kelvin, attack it.
Okay.
Wrong. We win.
It's the laziest goddamn ripoff of Gary Glitter that has ever been committed to tape. Wow, did you stay up all night writing that
this
lyric?
This song was... a little bit of water in the desert. It was an acknowledgement that this weird thing that we watched late at night on the Sesame Street channel actually existed and mattered to other people. The quality had nothing to do with it. It was really just that somebody else was saying Doctor Who out loud. and I could purchase that and play it. Made it the best song imaginable.
Even hearing Kelvin belittle it fills me with the warmest feelings deep inside. It is like my childhood revisited.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the vinyl we had was like a half an hour long of the same damn thing.
Yeah,
oh, and you'd flip it
it's
over.
Like we get
more
the
of the
point.
Same.
Exactly.
But I wanted the point, and I couldn't get enough of the point. Almost sexual. I don't know. So yeah, it's not a good song, but it was so needed at the time culturally that it doesn't matter that it was a poor song.
It sets out a job and it gets it done, Kelvin.
Yeah. Do I have the history of this song correct, that it started as the Doctor in the TARDIS and then started to be used in Sports Arena with the Doctor's lyrics stripped away? Do I have that correct?
It's the Gary Glitter song that it totally rips off.
Oh, okay. So, but this is another thing that gave me happiness as a child. I was wrong, but I thought that that song was stripped of the Doctor Who part and then just played in arenas, and I thought it was like, this
well,
is a great
I'm
subversion.
Not, I'm not
when,
yeah. Yeah.
When I went to sports shows where they did that, I would sing it. I'd just sing there and I'd go, Doctor Who.
This song
created... Yeah, like, you don't know what you're singing. Ha, 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 ha.
This song created a bubble of lies in which we could live comfortably within. You don't know what that does for a small Doctor Who fan in the 80s.
You're really getting double-teamed here, Kelvin. Do you have any final...
I'm not responsible for people's pop culture ignorance of rock and roll of the glitter era.
Kelvin, I've known you for decades, and that's the meanest thing you've ever said to me.
Advantage Scrimshaws. Yes. Sonic sunglasses.
Oh, I'll defend.
I'll attack. No, there's sunglasses, but he had to use them as sonic screwdrivers. He had to break off the handle and like jam it into a thing. That's not practical. Mm-hmm. You'll go through a lot of sonic sunglasses that way.
Okay, we've veered the argument into practicality of sunglasses, but then he doesn't even have to have pockets. He's got them on all the time, and it also serves as a very nice meta commentary on the ridiculousness of any sonic device, really. And I enjoyed it as a big sort of FU from Moffat to all the fans who complained about the sonic screwdriver, and sometimes it's nice to remind people of how it could be worse. You think you're unhappy now? And I personally love the sonic glasses. I think there should be more sonic devices that reflect the doctor of the period. You know, we could have had a sonic bow tie for
Sonic guitar.
Sonic guitar. That
a more sonic guitar.
So I actually legitimately enjoyed the sonic sunglasses, partly because of how much anger it caused in other people. It had to be the most insignificant thing in the history of Doctor Who to cause ire, I think, among fans.
I think it is pretty cool, since there's the whole deal with it meme where the sunglasses, you say something that people don't like, and then the sunglasses just land on the person's face and it says, deal with it. And Moffat basically made that meme. It's like, you don't like the sonic sunglasses? Deal with it.
Well, I'm going to give the advantage to you, Josh, because I didn't believe anything that I was saying. It's completely disingenuous. I like the sunglasses, too, and I'm not sure why I was attacking it in the first place.
But they can get knocked off. So yeah.
Yeah, they can get knocked off. And I don't understand why the control panel in that one episode had a port that you could just stick sonic sunglasses.
Like, it's been waiting all this time for the sonic sunglasses. Someday my port
will
matter.
It's shaped like the earpiece of the piece.
That's what holds the spring in place now.
Oh! Okay.
Peter Capaldi's eyebrows. Kelvin, attack.
It's a nice substitute for acting.
Joshua, defend.
It's a nice substitute for acting.
The clone Dr. Rose is given as a sex toy in the mirror dimension. Kelvin, defend.
Defend?
Aerial attack.
Thank you. I want to have a date again at some point in my life.
Well, I think that the doctor should never actually be allowed to get laid. So if there's a doctor that's going to be laid, it should be a clone doctor.
Oh, it's... Yeah.
No, Kelvin, no.
That's a good dodge. That's a good dodge. The doctor deserves some happiness somewhere in his long and tortured life, and if it has to be in an alternate universe...
It should never be with his companion. This is my argument. So, the clone, it's okay, but him, never.
But Rose is so mature.
I think we have time for one more. We will all defend the master eating cheeseburgers quickly.
He was hungry.
He was sort of hoping to regenerate, so he thought he might choke on it, you know, and get to move on to the next one.
It's what differentiates Doctor Who from every other television show on air, because nobody else would depict speed eating of cheeseburgers by their main diabolical villain as a way to make you go, ooh, the doctor's in trouble now. He can eat cheeseburgers fast. What will happen?
It's the doctor versus Super Wimpy.
I think that it was Russell T. Davies' way of implying that the master is half American.
Zing.
That's our podcast. Thank you to our guests, Ariel Leaf and Joseph Scrimshaw. Convergence for having us, and you, our live nerd audience. If you enjoy this podcast, please visit our website, getoffmyworldpodcast.com, subscribe on iTunes, or like us on Facebook, send us an email, any of those things. Until next time, I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Joseph.
I'm Ariel.
And we're saying, get off my world.